I gather it's fashionable in lecture theatres and universities nowadays to give trigger warnings, things that might distress people, get flagged up early. I want to talk about death this morning. It will take a while to get there, but I hope it won't be as depressing as it might sound, but that's where we're going. First of all, an overview of that passage that Aneirin read to us. Then just to consider briefly why Jesus did it that way, because it's a very odd conversation. And then thirdly, where that leaves us, because it has something to say to us. First of all, an overview. The first thing that you notice is that the importance of love is affirmed. Three times Jesus asks, "Do you love me?" What Peter needs to know about his relationship with Jesus, his ongoing relationship, is that the fundamental thing is that he loves his Lord. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Augustine, the great teacher and preacher and theologian of the early church, possibly the greatest orator in the ancient world after Cicero, asked his teacher once, what's the fundamental thing about rhetoric, about persuasive speaking? And his teacher said, pronunciation, pronunciation, pronunciation. Somebody once asked St. Bernard of Clairvaux, what are the three most important virtues are? And he famously replied, humility, humility, humility. He wasn't prone to show it, but he espoused it. Tony Blair's priority in the 2001 election, can you remember? Education, education, you see it sticks in my head, doesn't it? Love, love, love. The importance of love in our relationship with God is affirmed. Not just God's love for us, but our love for him. Importance of love affirmed. Love means action. Love always wants to do. Now it helps if he or she gives us a clue, doesn't it? You know, my family threatened to buy me aftershave because they love me and they want to save me from an encroaching fungoid growth. But I don't want aftershave, you see. I really don't want it. And they don't always take the hint when I tell them what I do want. Jesus here tells Peter exactly what he wants. Three times. Feed my sheep. The Good News Bible, wonderful document though it is, slightly obscures this, take care of. Feed is what Jesus said. Three times with slightly different wording. Now it doesn't mean setting up a catering business. If you want to know about that, talk to Doug. Wherever people are hungry, Mark, you'll usually find Christians trying to feed them. It means share with your brothers and sisters in Christ the truth of the gospel. And that's not just something for Pope Francis, who's sometimes referred to as the successor of Peter. It's not just something for people like me who have the excitement of standing up here and holding forth. It's for all of us. Feed my sheep. It's something we do for one another. Share the truth of the gospel. Importance of love affirmed. Love means action of a specific kind. And the cost of love is clearly stated. Jesus doesn't very often play at fortune teller. He doesn't predict much what's going to happen to people, though he knows. He tends to state that in very general terms, but here he does. He tells Peter how he is going to die, because Christian discipleship is about taking up our cross. Peter, the tradition has it, was crucified upside down in Rome. That's the broad headings, some of what Jesus is saying. Now, why does he do it this way? Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Feed my sheep, feed my sheep, feed my sheep. You're going to die. Imagine that you're having a dinner party and there are six other guests. One, two, three. Almost. I was close. And your husband, ladies, in that way that men sometimes have, he drags out into the conversation the most awful, the most embarrassing thing, the one thing you really don't want spoken about in this particular selection of people. he starts going on about it. And he does it not just once. Even after you've kicked him under the table, he does it again and again, three times. I think I can say that full and frank discussions would follow the dinner party, yes? Why does Jesus do something like that? Because that is what he's doing to Peter. He has his reasons, I think, and I think some of them are these. He wants to make Peter think about what he's saying. We saw last week how Peter is the impetuous one, the one who opens his mouth and then his brain has to catch up later. I can be a bit like that. The one who jumps off the boat. John recognized Jesus, but it was Peter who threw himself into the water. Peter needs to think about his commitment to Jesus, to think about what he's saying. I think Jesus is also demonstrating, in fact, that it's the teacher who sets the exam. That might seem obvious. A disciple is a learner. We don't set the questions. We don't set the answers. Jesus is the teacher. That's what rabbi means. He was called a rabbi by some of his friends and even some of his enemies. It's the teacher who sets the exam. It's the teacher who decides what the important questions are, what the important topics are. We need to remember that when we're tempted to rewrite or rejig what Jesus is saying to us in the New Testament to suit our particular wishes, don't we? Jesus is telling Peter that it's the master who decides what the servant does. Peter had said, I'm going fishing. I can't hang around here anymore waiting. I'm going fishing. I've got to do something. That's what it's going to be. But Jesus comes along and says, now, you're a shepherd now. Forget the fishing. Feed my sheep. He's trying to tell Peter, and he's trying to tell us, that we don't get to do the job that we want to do for him. He decides what we're going to do. You know, if I had my way, I'd be in Lambeth Palace. I've always wanted a pointy hat. But no, God parked me here in Henley-on-Thames. You might understand why. We don't get to decide. I'm speaking from personal experience here. Fourthly, and perhaps most importantly, Jesus is binding up Peter's wounds. He's closing the whole circle on that denial. You remember back in the high priest's courtyard, there was a charcoal fire burning, there was food cooking, and Peter denied Jesus just as Jesus had told him that he would, because he'd already... there's another fire, there's food cooking, it smells wonderful. And Peter three times confesses that he loves Jesus in a way that makes it impossible for him to misunderstand this time what he's doing and where it will lead him. This scene, it represents the transformation of the scene of Peter's greatest failure. His Gallipoli defeat, if you like, becomes a Waterloo victory. It's the Romans 8:28 trick that Jesus works so often. Do you know Romans 8:28? Paul writes, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. God has called Peter, and Peter has repeatedly blundered. But Jesus is undoing that. He is making a new start possible. And he'll do that for us too. God uses us. God calls us. God tells us what we want to do. And yes, we mess it up, but God does use us. And I sometimes think it's the defeats that God uses to best effect, actually. That's why Jesus is doing what he's doing. Peter's got to get hold of the point this time and not forget it. And we'll see in Acts that by and large he has. Where does all that leave us? I think, first of all, it tells us that we personally need time with Jesus. Now, Peter really needed this meeting. Yeah, he needed to know Jesus' word to him individually. He was the one who'd messed up in the high priest's courtyard. He needed to know not that God loves humanity, which is a wonderful motherhood and apple pie kind of sentiment. He needed to know that God loved him. And I think we need to know that individually. Coming to church, singing your heart out, listening to sermons, heaven help you, praying together, getting involved, those are all good things. But for the Christian faith really to work in you, there has to be some personal encounter with Jesus. What do I mean by that? Well, Peter needs to spend some time in the presence of the one whom he denied and who died for him to ensure that Peter's weakness and cowardice and limitation wouldn't stand between him and a holy God forever. Peter can only really understand that by meeting Jesus. He needs to meet him. So do we. So, you know, he needs to squirm at the realization of his own ability to mess things up, to let himself and everybody else down. His own talent for betraying his best ideals, his own gift for hurting other people, even inadvertently. He needed to know that. So do we. Personally. You know, it's you. And all of us need to get close enough to Jesus to hear his words of promise, his word of forgiveness to us personally. That's why I chose that picture. That's why Christians spend so much time reading the Bible, especially working through the Gospels. That's why Christians spend so much time in prayer. Because if you read this book, a lot of it will float by. But every now and again, you're going to come across something that nails you, that really speaks to you. It speaks to what you've done. It speaks to the mess you've made. But it also speaks about what God will do about that, and the blessing that God will bring out of that, and the forgiveness that God in Jesus offers to that. Personal time with Jesus, that's the first thing we need to know about. Second thing is this: dictating to God must die, must stop. I don't know if you've ever wondered, it's often occurred to me, but whether Peter was actually older than Jesus. I've never thought about it really until I was looking at this week, but he's doing the big brother thing, isn't he? I mean, my little sister is 5 years younger than me, which is to say she's now 53, and I still talk to her like a 10-year-old addressing a 5-year-old sometimes, you know? Big brother sharing his insight, sharing his worldly wisdom, just letting this inexperienced youngster know what's what, you know. At 53, she's seen a lot of life and been through more than I have in many, many ways. And there are times when you get a bit of that with Peter. He's always giving Jesus advice, sharing his wisdom and experience with this younger man, possibly. I don't know. I mean, we're not told about that, but it smells like that to me. The most famous example is in Matthew 16, where Jesus is, for the first time, telling his disciples what's going to happen. He's going to go, he's going to be crucified, and on the third day he's going to be raised from the dead, except it's the crucified bit that sticks in everybody's mind. And Peter says, no, you don't want to do that. Jesus calls Peter Satan. Now you would think that Peter might have learnt from that, but no, it goes on. Dictating to God must stop. That's what this little story at the end of John 21 tells us. Yet many of us are happy to be used by God in a consulting capacity, but that's not how it works. God speaks, we listen, we respond. Not because he's some cosmic bully, but because that's where we're going to be blessed. It leaves us knowing that faith means action. I found a wonderful sermon by Charles Spurgeon, great Baptist preacher, the last of the Puritans in many ways, on this text. And He's talking about growing in faith, about personal time with Jesus, about responding to the call, and in particular, I think he's talking about the beginnings of the Keswick Convention up in the Lake District, lots of people gathering together to strengthen each other in the faith. And he writes this: "I see a company of brethren met together to hold a conference and to grow in grace. Very excellent indeed. Grow away, brothers and sisters. Grow as fast as you can. I like to see you as a flower garden, all are growing, all are blowing in the breeze. But when you've done all that, I pray you, do not congratulate yourselves as though you had done a mighty fine thing, because there is nothing in it unless it leads you to work for others. To publish accounts of such happy gatherings is like telling the poor people of Whitechapel, it was in those days, that the Lord Mayor and Alderman had a fine banquet of turtle soup. Suppose I read that you've had a splendid series of meetings. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed yourselves, but the point is this: if there is anything in it, get to work." And by work, of course, Spurgeon and Christ meant feed the sheep, share the gospel, take the good news of Jesus to those who haven't heard it or those who've rejected it. Do it. Faith means action. It means action of that sort. And it's not just for Pope Francis or for people like me. It's for all of us. And finally, it leaves us facing what Peter faced. Peter must die. And Jesus tells him how that's going to happen. We must die too. Let me remind you. Truly, truly, I say to you, and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. And then John inserts in brackets, and he was there, remember. This he said to show by what kind of death he, that is Peter, was to glorify God. So Peter wanted to go fishing, but no, he's going to be a shepherd from now on. He would feed Christ's flock, both literally and spiritually. And he would be a good shepherd, so much so that, like the good shepherd, he would be crucified. He would hold out his arms. And many of his brothers and sisters in Christ, right down to the present day in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere, they are suffering the same fate. Let's remember them. But have I got that text on the slide? Yes, I have. I can't be the only one who has thought that Jesus' description of Peter's death, it sounds like the weakness of very advanced old age. Hands stretched out, maybe on the Zimmer frame or something, needing to be dressed, even carried. I don't know how I am going to leave this world, and I don't know how you are going to leave this world. I don't know how you're going to make the journey, whether it's going to be something dramatic like that or the kind of process that's symbolised by that wonderful piece of aluminium there. I'm not trying to depress you by pointing that out, but I can say this: it is possible to live to God's glory, and it's possible to die to his glory too. You can offer the whole business of life, all its ups and its downs, its victories, its defeats to God, and he will use them. Perhaps especially he uses the defeats. You can offer the business of growing old to God too. I've begun to realise this over the last year or two as the grave marks start to appear on my hands. You know what I'm talking about. You can offer the business of growing old to God. You can offer the business even of dying. That wonderful man, George Whitfield, possibly the only real example of a latter-day St. Peter, George Whitfield, he said, "Until God is done with me, I am immortal." It's not a comfortable thought, but it can be liberating in its own way. Tony Snow. Does anybody know who Tony Snow was? I bet you don't. Some of our American brothers and sisters might have a clue. He was George Bush's press officer. Don't hold that against him. He died 7 years ago. He died at the age of 53, colonic cancer. And he wrote a wonderful, wonderful article. He was a Roman Catholic layman, but he wrote a wonderful article for Christianity Today, when he knew that he had cancer and there was no way back. And he said this: the moment you enter the valley of the shadow of death, things change. And you discover that Christianity isn't something doughy and passive and pious and soft. Faith may be the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen, but it also draws you into a world shorn of fearful caution. The life of belief, it teems with thrills and boldness and danger and shocks and reversals and triumphs and epiphanies. Think of Paul traipsing through the known world and contemplating trips to what must have seemed like the Antipodes, Spain, shaking the dust from his sandals, worrying not about the morrow, but only for the moment. There's nothing wilder than the life of humble virtue, because it's through selflessness and service that God wrings from our bodies and spirits the most we could ever give, the most we ever could offer, the most we ever could do. Finally, we can let love change everything. Tomorrow, we're going to gather here, some of us, many of us, I'm guessing, and give thanks for someone who did exactly that, someone who lived in that spirit. Because we're going to be giving thanks for Eve Brockington. And Eve had a hard life. I won't be able to say all this tomorrow. Eve had a hard life. But she brought it all to God. She loved to pray. She waited upon her Lord for a word for her from him. If you've ever prayed with Eve, it was an amazing experience, and she brought all